These niggas are lying to you guys. They are lying. They're not good at their jobs. They're not good at their jobs. They're not good at their jobs. And they're reaffirming white ideas about blackness and trying to tell us it's a revolution. Kiss my black ass. That's what I would say to all of them. You can come at me. Like, really, have fun with that. I can actually fight, unlike a lot of other people I know.
Hi, I'm Eric, and this is For Colored Nerds, the weekly show where we peel back the layers of black culture we rarely discuss in mixed company. This week, I got to chat with Vulture film and TV critic Angelica Jade Bastian. Angelica's written some of the most researched, critical, fun, and some would say divisive reviews of the films featuring black characters and stories that we have all been obsessing over. We invited her to the studio to talk about the challenges of critiquing black content on the internet, what's missing from the movies we love, and we take a wonderfully spicy detour into the latest season of the FX hit show Atlanta. You don't want to miss that, and you don't want to miss this interview. We let it rip. More with myself and Angelica after this break.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium-iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Chief antagonist to MCU Twitter.
Oh my God.
Angelica Jade Bastian. No, seriously, you're my favorite critic. Welcome to For Colored Nerds. How are you doing today?
You know what, man? These MCU movies, I'm like, I don't even, they take up such little brain space in my mind as a critic. Yeah. But the way people talk about me, they're like, wow, you really be hating shit, Angelica. And I'm like, no, actually, I love film. I'm sorry, yeah. Most things are just mediocre.
Hey, so it's funny because, like, as I mentioned, you're one of my favorite critics, like favorite film critics.
Aww,
and
thank you.
I also am a pretty big diehard MCU fan.
Nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And for what it's worth, I read all of them. And the thing that I often have to admit is that you are right. Like, about 99% of the time, in terms of, like, how you are assessing the film, I think what maybe people get stuck on is, like, you can still like something that maybe is constructed imperfectly.
I was going to say terribly, but sure, imperfectly sounds okay. I like a lot of movies that are trash, but yeah. I will say, this is trash. It's made terribly, but it hits a pleasure center. And that's like totally okay, but it's like my job to discuss cinematography, acting, shot setups, framing, all the things that go into making a film. Yes. And if they're not good, they're not good. But when people call me pretentious, I have to laugh. Like, because I gave Michael Bay's most recent film, Ambulance, a very high-minded, beloved review because it was fun as shit. It's so dumb. But it's like really just well-made action. And also, I love a movie where I can be like, wow, everyone involved in this movie dove into a mountain of cocaine before every single scene. And I was like, that's beautiful. That's
especially beautiful. Jake Gyllenhaal. If you haven't seen the movie Ambulance, it's pretty good. It's a fun ride. It's ridiculous.
Oh, it's so dumb. Like, it is the dumbest thing I have seen in a very long time. But Jake Gyllenhaal, him screaming about his cashmere sweater was like, I was like, you know what? This is cinema.
Michael Bay, an auteur of our time. You know, I want to say, just like whether you're happy or whether you're pissed, I typically always hear where you're coming from. And your reviews are so layered and it clearly come from such a place of like deep passion and knowledge, which like makes me wonder to start, where did your love for film and film criticism begin?
You know, I had a very different road to this profession than I think a lot of other critics, because they grew up like, I loved film and I made little films with my dad on some Super 8 camera or whatever the hell they were doing. And for me, I have always loved pop culture, but I never thought of myself as, oh, I love film. If someone asked me about myself when I was a kid, I wouldn't be like, oh yeah, I love film. Yeah. For me, it was more like, I love storytelling. That is what I love. I love the stories we tell ourselves to get through the day. I love narrative construction. I love mythology. But it took me going to an art high school in Miami, Florida, where I grew up. And you basically, you had your usual school day, right? All the usual bullshit you have to deal with. Then on top of that, you have an art history class, a drawing class, and a major, basically. They called it a strand. And one of them was film. And I was like, I don't know what I want to do. Graphic design wasn't hidden. And I was like, yeah, I like movies. Sure, I'll do this. And then in the class, I saw, like, in the first like week or so, Mr. Pike was my teacher. I remember him very clearly. He showed us a few classic Hollywood films I had never seen before, including To Have and Have Not with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall.
Ernest Hemingway, soldier of fortune, who can always be found where adventure beckons, now takes you to the danger zone of the mid-Atlantic.
The Third Man, which is an amazing film, and The Sting with Robert Redford and my king, Paul Newman, hottest white man to ever live in Hollywood.
Paul Newman is Henry Gondorf. There wasn't a con he couldn't run, and there wasn't a sucker he couldn't gaff. Robert Redford is Johnny Hooker, a young grifter.
I'm like, most of these white men are like, I pass them on the street in Chicago, I wouldn't notice them. Paul Newman, I would notice.
For as far as Robert Redford was my guy growing up. So The Sting was like on my list. But yeah, keep going.
I love The Sting. It's just a fun movie. And it just really sparked what would become now a lifelong obsession with learning and studying film. I think of myself, and this is going to sound pretentious, I consider myself a scholar of film. And I think a problem with criticism is not enough scholars. They're not enough, you know, studying the form, in my opinion. That really got me started. And then I went to college for screenwriting, of all things, and took a smattering of film criticism classes. And the ones that really stuck out to me and really set me on this path were the ones I took with a teacher named Jeffrey John Smith when I came up to Chicago and went to school here, another art school. I don't know why I was doing that to myself. Class called Star as Auteur on Cary Grant, Star as Auteur on Bette Davis, and a whole entire class dedicated to the film Gone with the Wind. So,
wow,
which is very interesting as a black person being in that class.
That seems like a semester. I would have been going through it.
Oh, yeah. It was, but I learned so much and it sparked an interest. And then, you know, I get out of college and I'm like, I don't want to do screenwriting. I want more control over my career than you get as a screenwriter. That doesn't feed me in the way I need to be fed. And so I fucked around for a few years working odd jobs until I started, you know, writing on the side and then freelancing full time. And then now I've been on staff with Vulture since 2017.
Wow. Yeah. So like I could not have you of all critics on the show and not have a bit of the like Red Tails argument that I think everybody like basically tries to like engage you in on Twitter. You know, that age old question, do we have to love every single black movie so that they will continue to make any black movies? Yeah. So you seem like you were going to or the sigh that I feel a million times. I think we both know the answer is no. But like, and we're also just at a point where there's literally never been more black TV or film. There's a lot of stuff available. But I guess I'm curious, like, why you think it's so hard to move on from this argument? And, like, how does its seemingly eternal presence, like, affect your work as a critic?
Ooh, that is a very heavy question. And you know what? I'm going to get a little spicy.
Let's do it.
So my whole thing is, no, we do not have to love every black film. And if you are doing that, you're actually being condescending to artists by just accepting trash. Also, my question to people is, you know, there's black film made outside of Hollywood, outside of America that you could support. That's really amazing and great. And I don't know, watch Air Conditioner, watch Atlantiques. Like there's a lot of amazing cinema with Black people out, especially from the continent of Africa. Yeah. Like, and then my question to people who are like, well, we have to support or Hollywood's never going to be making stuff again. First of all, they're not, because they realize, oh, our bottom line has been struggling. We're in a very weird spot right now with pop culture, specifically film. So, of course, they're giving Negro stuff now, because they're like, oh, they literally always turn to us when they're struggling. Think of the Blaxploitation era. There's a very sure boom and bust cycle in Black representation that you can track throughout the entirety of film in America. From silent period onward, right?
Exactly. I think about UPN.
UPN. Remember UPN? What a time. Mm. We were so lucky growing up, and then it got bad.
Yeah, it's like that time. But we were 8 years in power or something like that. Like, we had whatever years we had UPN, we were that many years in power. And then it took over.
But my question to people who bring that up is, why are you so hungry for white acceptance from Hollywood? Why do you think an industry that is basically an arm of propaganda for our government, which, surprise, does not give a shit about us, why would you think they would holistically show the beauty and breadth of Blackness? Hmm. Why are you so hungry for them to do that? Why are you so hungry for that seat at the table instead of burning it down? I don't know.
Man.
That's just, think about it.
I'm curious, like, do you feel like in your writing, you're responding to any of that, or like, does that affect any of your pursuit with trying to like review a film?
For me, it's a really weird struggle, I think, as a critic, because criticism at its best is a conversation with the audience, in my opinion. Yeah. You're shepherding the audience to look at things in new ways and consider historical connections. I think of critics as a part of the historical record in a way. Mm-hmm. I think for me, when I've been stopped, let's say, from writing something, it's more like, okay, I've done too many negative reviews on Black people shit for a minute. I need to take a break, because it's going to look some sort of way. Not because I don't want to write about it, but I think you need balance in your career. I don't want everyone to look at me and be like, oh yeah, she's just a hater. All she does is write negative reviews. You have to mix it up. So, you know, that's a struggle that is sometimes at the back of my head, but for me, I just let my passion and desires guide me and hope that I have honest-ass friends in my corner who will call me out like, girl, you don't do this. And thankfully, I do have really good friends who know to... I've never had a friend be like, yeah, Angelica, you shouldn't have done that. But it's good to have guardrails of specifically Black and brown friends who will be like, yeah, you hit it, fuck them haters, or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I try not to let the voice of audiences get into my head when I'm writing. A mentor told me when I was in college a very long time ago, you can't control the echoes. Listen to your own voice.
Woo.
And I've held on to that for a very long time. I let people take my work whatever way they want to take it. That is up to people. That is all a part of being a creative person. You let stuff out into the world and then people will take it whichever direction they want to take it. And I just let my work speak for itself. Like, I try not to get into Twitter fights, especially with these Marvel fans. They are very intense. I made a slight joke about Mr. Christopher Evans and maybe his hairline or something like that. And they got crazy. I was like, oh my God, like, this white man is not going to fuck you. So defending him on the internet is not doing anything.
And also, if the man has plugs, that's fine. Let him have plugs. He paid for them. It's okay.
Fine. Look, we're all getting older, and some of us are, you know, struggling with the hair stuff. Not me, but, you know, my heart goes out to all those men.
There's a review that I feel like is a good example of kind of, I think, some of the reactions that you get that feels in this conversation. Mm-hmm. And it is your review of the 2021 reboot of Candyman.
Oh, God.
So, look, the original Candyman obviously has this massive cult following. And for what it's worth, is one of my actual, like, all-time favorite horror movies. Probably, like, might even be top five for me.
I mean, Tony Todd's performance.
Oh, my God.
And Bernard Rose's direction and Clive Barker's whole sensibilities really work well. I think there's gristle to that film, because I think sometimes we as Black people don't know how to reckon with quote unquote black art that may be created or have more white people involved behind the scenes. Mm. And I think Candyman is one of those like weird films that is really interesting to unpack. But sorry, continue.
No, exactly. Literally, that's all the reasons why I'm really into it. But the update, you know, as you noted in your review, it felt honestly bad and kind of boring at times. Or you reacquainted so many people with the word didactic. So I agreed for the most part with your review. But man, oh man, did Black Twitter disagree with you, at least on the day it came out.
Yeah.
When you review a film like Candyman, you know, and to be honest, I thought you actually went kind of easy on it compared to Walter Chow.
Walter is funny. And I don't think I went, I have never in my life gone easy on anything. So let's correct
I just
the
mean
record.
I hear you. I respect. I'm not trying to come for you. I'm just saying in comparison, Walter like eviscerated this
he
man.
He really hated it.
Oh my God.
It. Yeah.
But I'm curious, like, how are you hoping that Black readers engage this type of review? Ignoring the chatter that you definitely received, how are you kind of hoping people engage this?
Same way I hope they engage with all my work, which is read it for what is on the page. Please do not project onto me whatever ideas you have about my Blackness. You're probably going to be wrong. I'm just saying, people love to be like, oh, they're biracial. They're not really Black. And I'm like, that's very strange. I'm not biracial, so I don't know where you're getting that
either
from.
Either way.
Both my parents are Black. All my grandparents are Black. But what I hope for is that people read the work, thoroughly engage with it, whether they like it or not, agree with it or not. And I hope it sparks them to read and watch more voraciously and with more curiosity. That is what I hope for.
In that context, like, what's a Black horror film you wish people might have caught as opposed to that Candyman? Because I mean, I was rooting for Nia DaCosta.
I was too. I really was. I honestly, I feel like my blame is not on Nia with this. I think there's a thing sort of happening in Hollywood, which is true of people beside putting aside race, but I think it's especially true for directors of color, where they have an indie film and then they're forced to like jump into like big budget shit that they're not prepared for. They have not developed their voice enough. It's definitely the industry utilizing their identity as a way to reaffirm their bottom line. And it's actually heartbreaking to see. But in terms of Black horror film, well, it hasn't come out yet. Nkiatu Jusu's Nanny is amazing. I really, really responded well to that film. I don't think it's perfect, but what it's doing with the grammar of film is far more interesting than what we're seeing now. I think a big problem where I'm coming up against as a critic is noticing that a lot of these filmmakers of color are not creating their own grammar. What they're doing is using the language that white auteurs have set for us as if that is the highest you can go with filmmaking. I want to see motherfuckers experiment. Where are these motherfuckers doing some Terrence Nance random acts of flyness shit? Mm. Like, that show is amazing, and it's so experimental with form and function and its cinematography and what we expect. That's what I'm hungry for from Black filmmakers, especially.
You obviously like center and really look for a level of quality in terms of like how films treat the narratives of, I think, women overall, but especially Black women, I think, in your work. That feels like a through line. And a lot, for what it's worth, a lot of your fury feels like it's saved for those movies that really kind of fail them.
Yeah.
I think about Bad Hair, you know, where you seemed, frankly, a little irritated that, like, at the lack of empathy that the movie seemed to have for, you know, the Black women in the film. And it kind of used that to, like, justify, you know, all the terror that they receive. I think about Them. The Amazon show.
One of my best opening lines. I almost wish I saved it for something else, but it worked really well for it.
I actually have it right here. You said, in 2018, the artist Lorraine O'Grady said at a Brooklyn Museum book event, in the future, white supremacy will no longer need white people. That future is now.
I am really proud of that review. I think it's very cutting.
It's amazing. But these stories were from Black creators who somehow really felt like the work was actually advancing the stories of Black women. And I'm curious, like, how you experience these film narratives failing Black women today. And, like, do you think things have been, like, because in their mind, these movies are a shift. Like, do you think things are actually... Sorry, I can see... Your face is
amazing. These niggas are lying to you guys. They are lying. They're not good at their jobs. They're not good at their jobs. They're not good at their jobs. And they're reaffirming white ideas about blackness and trying to tell us it's a revolution. Kiss my black ass. That's what I would say to all of them. You can come at me. Like, really, have fun with that. I can actually fight, unlike a lot of other people I know.
Because it's not like people aren't having these conversations after a lot of these like movies or shows come out. Is it an echo chamber that causes a lot of a lack of evolution in terms of how black women are treated? Like, I guess I'm curious, like, where you feel like its root is from, because you see so much of it.
I mean, the root of it is white supremacy and the fact that white people control the levers of power in Hollywood. Yes, there's more black people we're seeing in front of the camera and slightly behind the camera, but in terms of like who's running studios, who's green lighting what, I think Kyatu posted on Twitter once, and I'm paraphrasing, it's not like the films you want to see by black people aren't being pitched and like argued for in these rooms. It's just they're not being greenlit. And so I think that's something to kind of keep in mind and something I try to remember. I'm like, yeah, I think a lot of these niggas aren't my kinfolk, in my opinion, but I don't blame them. I blame the structure we all have to move through, whether you're a critic writing about it or a filmmaker in the industry. It always comes down to the narrow ideas white people have about us. And I think there's black people who feel like they can subvert things or, you know, like add some flavor to what we've seen before and that's enough. And I'm like, y'all ain't subverting shit. Like, I'm sorry. Also, the filmmaking isn't there. That is a big problem for me. It's not just, oh, wow, the politics of them, for example, is a mess. Yeah, it's a mess and terrible. And it's like, do we really need this graphic rape scene, death of a baby flashback episode, which was directed by Danixa Bravo, who is a black woman. So
we're complicit.
Yeah, you know, we are. Complicit. Yeah. And, you know, for me, my politics and my love of film and what I believe its possibilities are prohibit me from lying. I'm not going to pretend something is good. Also, people have this very strange idea that art, like history and politics, progress in a straight line and that everything's always getting better than what came before. With Roe v. Wade and what we're seeing happening in everywhere from Palestine to the shores of Miami, LA, New York, everywhere in this country, I mean, across the globe, we should all kind of come to terms with the fact that that's not true.
Yeah, things are regressing.
Things are not good. Like the vibes are bleak. It's bad out there. And it's just like art does not progress in a straight line like that. Like, that's just not how it is. Just because your black ass has access to better equipment than, say, Bill Gunn, who made Ganja and Hess, his ass bodies all of you guys. Like, it's sad.
Talk about it. What are the things recently, you mentioned Nanny, like, what are the other things that are getting at this kind of deeper exploration of blackness, or that are kind of doing some of the work of kind of interrogating, you know, narratives beyond what white development executives would provide for us?
I think one of my favorite things that has come out in the last few years, and even though, let me preface this by saying, even though I am also a TV critic, I think most people know film is where the meat of it really lies for me, but The Underground Railroad, Barry Jenkins's series.
Yes.
The craft is there. The craft is there. Yeah, I mean,
it's beautiful.
What's interesting about Barry Jenkins and the Underground Railroad specifically is you can tell he's taking cues, especially with the very languid tracking shots and very fluid camera movements. He's taking cues from filmmakers who admittedly are white, John Renoir and Max Ophuls, who I'm big fans of. But he's also taking shit from filmmakers of color. You can see other inspirations there. And I think always whenever I watch him, of like Wong Kar-wai, for example. And the beauty of that show is its depth, its layers, how it is not creating a very neat narrative. And I think its relationship to the body, what it means to exist in a black body as a human being, is very fascinating. Some of its most harrowing moments are told to us. We're not seeing them, which I think is a very smart choice, because I think there is no way, in my opinion, for a film or TV show to fully show the horror, basically, of slavery without tripping into being trauma porn, because the reality of that existence is harrowing. So I think Barry Jenkins and his collaborators, including the composer, Nicholas Britell, James Laxton, the cinematographer, they just know what the fuck they are doing. And they're creating a character in Cora who is so complex and so fascinating and so resistant to just loving her easily. She's like an enigma that you slowly understand more and more of. It was funny because I praised this show above and beyond. Like, I am still very obsessed with it. But I did say that I felt like Cora as a character is all trauma response. But that wasn't an insult. That was like, I actually think that's interesting and makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, it was a very traumatic experience. Like, her life was horrifying, you know, in many respects. That show, I agree, really just kind of like took my breath away. It was an experience I haven't had, to your point. So often when the violence from, you know, that period is rendered, there's a horror that you experience that you're like, this is too much. And I think when I was watching the show, there were points that were really, really intense, but they were rendered with such care that I was able to not necessarily distance myself from what they were experiencing, but understand more of the context. Yeah. I think you can be so blinded by the horror that you can't get the additional context that they're trying to provide. And I think you, as you mentioned, like all the different components, the cinematography, the, you know, the music, Nicholas Britell, amazing so score, good. All those things come together to really guide you in terms of how to feel through this type of experience. Up next, Angelica and I dive into the show everyone has been arguing about recently. There's another show that is very different and maybe tries the hardest to feel like a deeper exploration of Blackness. That show, for me, at least right now, is Atlanta.
Let me drink some of my kombucha.
Take a sip. We're about to go there. Our thoughts about the latest season of Atlanta and Donald Glover after the break.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah, of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Mm-hmm. There's another show that is very different and maybe tries the hardest to feel like a deeper exploration of Blackness. Mm. That show, for me, at least right now, is Atlanta.
Let me drink some of my kombucha.
Take a sip. We about to go there.
You're not worried about, you know, what the streets think?
The streets?
Bro, what the f***?
I think you need to live more in the moment.
Are you sure you want this? Oh,
yeah. So, in your review about the second season, this is a quote. You said much of the horror and experiences of the characters feel urgent because they are weighted with the existential concerns of its Black audience who are trying to define themselves in a world in which reality is shifting into further surreality. So you wrote that about Atlanta's second season about four years ago.
It's a while.
And now the show has just wrapped its third season, which has been wildly divisive, even for this show. How are you liking the season so far? And do you think they have strayed from kind of those aims that you lauded?
Yeah, it's really funny because I was like, yeah, I really dug seasons one and two. I think there are like minute issues. I do not think they have ever gotten a handle on Van Zazie Beetz's character.
I'm coming
and
to that
I think that's a tell. And since this is coming out after the show finishes airing, I've already seen the finale, so we can kind of get into whatever. So I think there's been an interesting push and pull with this season because its gaze has gone into a different direction.
Yes, definitively. Like
I'm working on an essay about it, so I still have a lot of thoughts I'm mulling over. But one thing I think people are struggling with is that these bottle episodes are a little too focused on whiteness. And here's my problem. I think it's really interesting for Black filmmakers to be like, okay, white people, we about to come for your ass and like look at all your issues and dig into it. It's framing whiteness in Atlanta, but it's not critiquing it with any depth or nuance. I'm like, nigga, like I've had these conversations in little Twitter chats. Like this isn't really actually doing much. And I think, especially with the bottle episodes, and actually throughout the show, because we've had Chet Hanks, who is not just a motherfucker who likes to put on a Trini or Jamaican accent. He's known to have abused his Black girlfriend. So there's that. Liam Neeson making fun of his own image and his whole line of, I'm paraphrasing, but the greatest and worst thing about being a white person is you don't have to learn if you don't want to.
But then you learn that you shouldn't say shit like that.
Why? But I also learned that the best and worst part about being white is you don't have to learn anything if you don't want to. Take it easy, paper boy.
And there's, you know, the reparations episode. And then, and I think it's really the Chet Hanks, Liam Neeson, and then Kevin Samuels popping up in the black and white episode.
Yeah.
Okay, Donald Glover, you aren't probably going to listen to this, so it doesn't matter, but you have a thing for saying people don't call you out by name, so I'm calling you out by name. Nigga, what the fuck are you doing? You're insulting Black people under the guise of being a provocateur. That's not provocative. Actually, it's really lazy to give a platform to terrible people, two of whom are so misogynistic that they're enacting active material harm on Black women. So people's jokes about you not liking Black women, it's not a joke anymore. It's you putting money in the pockets of people who are misogynists. Like, the misogynoir, there's Kevin Samuels, terrible human being. Oh, he died. I don't give a shit, okay? If there's a hell, his Black ass is sitting alongside, I don't know, Ronald Reagan and niggas like that. How about that? You can come at me for that. I don't give a shit. And so the problem is, like, on a narrative level, it feels very disjointed because of the bottle episodes. So there's, like, layers to the issues. Yeah. You're taking the characters we know out of the context of Atlanta, okay? You're putting them in the context of high-minded, beautiful, old European shit, aka white.
White.
You're trying to critique whiteness, but you're very obsessed with its aesthetics, which is kind of not working. And then you're not giving the characters we know much of anything to do. They really didn't do much this season or like didn't like evolve or grow. We didn't see new layers to them. It's just kind of like them fucking.
This is a moment in time.
Exactly. Yeah. And but then at the same time with the bottle episodes, they're trying to like have a message. And I'm like, you guys don't have the depth, the knowledge, and the wherewithal politically to pull this off. The craft, while beautiful and glossy, is actually very inert, in my opinion. The choice of black and white in the last episode that Donald Glover directed, actually, it was basic. I was like, this isn't even interesting looking black and white. It's just like, oh, we decided to do black and white because it gives it like a Twilight Zone feel without the Twilight Zone actual aesthetics, I guess. Like,
our producer was like, somebody just watched Passing, basically.
Yeah, and I'm like, you took the wrong lessons, my nigga. Like, the fuck are you doing? But the finale is when I was like, are y'all trolling us? Like, because this is just now. So basically, the finale focuses on Van in Paris. Mm-hmm. So we're, and you don't see Earn, you don't see Paperboy. It's just Van in like this little chic bobbed wig walking around Paris with a fake French accent. And friends that knew her in Atlanta bump into her and they go on this very weird adventure that like basically shows that Van is like kind of unraveling in a way. I think it's trying to make fun of rich people, but I'm like, y'all are those people. Okay. But it doesn't really give us a deeper understanding of her character because it is so wrapped up in the aesthetics of Paris and richness and wealth. Oh, also, Alexander Skarsgård pops up. It's a very weird episode. Yeah.
Really? 2022 is it's been a fascinating year so far. I want to echo all the shit that you said. It's been so perplexing because I think I was where you were. The first season of Atlanta, I really loved. I bought one of those like cheesy like watercolor prints of the key art. It's like in my house. But Teddy Perkins, I thought was like one of the most fascinating episodes of television that like I had seen. I was like, wow, this is really, they're trying some shit. And then this season, it's like they forgot every lesson that they might have learned. You mentioned like taking them out of the context of Atlanta, which was so kind of foundational, I think, to like the actual subversion that the show like excelled at, because you got to see black people within context and us experiencing this surreality amongst each other. And that was like, wow, it's like, you know, it's like great. But now you have just like, you actually, I feel like you get told more about white people than you are actually about the core black people in the show. I want to come back to Van and like the fact, like their kind of inability to render her. It's interesting. So like Atlanta is like one of the biggest kind of prestige black TV shows. I would say the only other one I think comes close, actually, is probably Insecure, actually probably being higher.
I will say, we need to let go of the word prestige. That word has lost all fucking meaning in television. I think people are saying prestige because it's like, wow, that looks like there's money behind it. And I'm like, okay, we need to let go of the word because it doesn't even make sense anymore.
Absolutely. And that's actually what I want to ask about. Like, I think something that is really interesting about Insecure is that, like, for Insecure's quote-unquote prestige, I thought they were still actually really good at rendering black men, even though they weren't the focus.
Oh, totally. They cared a lot more about black men than my ass be doing. I'll be saying that. No, I'm kidding. I love you guys.
A couple of us, we're trying. A couple of, you know. No, but they render them pretty beautifully. And it's interesting that Atlanta, for a similar construction of just like a core kind of group of friends, in this case, mostly male, their inability to render Van throughout the whole, it's been a running theme throughout the whole
show,
is kind of wild. And so I guess I'm curious, like, for you, what does prestige apply to? Like, what makes something a prestige show? How far does it have to go?
I mean, I'm going to say straight up, prestige is not a word I would ever use to describe something right now, because I think television, well, I think America in general is in her flop era. I mean, kind of always has been, but like she's really flopping now. And you can see it in film and television. But television, I'm trying not to say things that will piss off other like TV critics because I have spicy thoughts about shit. But if you're saying something is prestige, and then that always leads to somebody saying, oh, it's cinematic, which I'm like, what the fuck does that mean? You're going to have to experiment more. You're going to have to, like, try something that I will be shocked by. Mm. You have to also have because prestige really does equal this show has money and I can see it on screen based on the glossy, beautiful aesthetics of the cinematography, the fact that these bitches are wearing some straight up designer ass clothing. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, it has a certain je ne sais quoi that is actually very white to me. Because when you think about it, it's that's what it really comes down to when people are like, oh, it's cinematic. Oh, it's prestige television. They're saying it has money that I can see on screen.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it treats its own narrative with a level of importance and an assured quality. That doesn't mean it's good, but it just, you can tell these artists are doing things. So, you know, like, yeah, Atlanta is prestigey. Also, we're saying prestige because it's like, oh, white critics really love these shows and they will defend them. Like, till it's kind of funny. And I'm like, you know, I have met a lot of these little white critics. They do not be having black friends, so do not give a shit about what they be saying. Yep. Let me just tell you, a lot of these major white critics do not fuck with niggas. And it shows in their work.
Yeah. I was explaining to someone not too long ago, one of my white friends, the concept of waiting for the black review. There was a movie coming out. He was like, "Have you seen it?" And I was like, "No, I saw people talking about it, but I'm waiting for the black review." And he was like, "Well, what do you mean?" And I was like, "Well, a review from a black person, because it's about black people. All these reviews, I can't really trust." You know what I'm saying? I was just like, I can't engage this shit with my normal feel. I need to go with somebody who I know shares at least a little bit of the sensibility.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, I know people, I exist in that realm for people. They're like, okay, yeah, I'm seeing what these people are saying, but what does Angelica think about this? Because she'll actually say what she thinks. Because also, not all these black critics are created equal. Mm. Some of y'all, I don't really fucking like and don't think you're good at your job. So take that as you will. But then there's other people who I'm like, for example, Shamir Ibrahim, a close friend of mine. Amazing writer. Lauren Michelle Jackson. Yes. She is more doing literary criticism. Amazing writer. Mm-hmm. You know, there are, you know, actually, I think the people who are doing amazing work in cultural criticism, they're black women. It's the black women who are actually like Doreen St. Felix, an amazing writer as well. Yes. There's a lot of like, you know, good criticism out there coming from black people. But it's not always going to be the criticism that is highly supported, in my opinion.
It's weird. Like, I think there overall has been a flattening of criticism with, like, as social has gotten bigger, you know, like, the amount of people who can, and even access to the internet, the amount of people who can become a critic has changed. And, you know, in addition to that, like, the way people engage with criticism, I think, is a little different because it's so, like, muddied. But I'm curious, like, how do you think about the importance of criticism? Like, it feels like maybe it's lost a step and even some of its kind of prestige in the moment we're in.
So for me, you know, on one hand, I'm like, social media and the state we're in right now with journalism is exactly why I've been able to become a critic. I would not be able to have the career I have now 10, 20 years earlier, right? And that's great. It's great that it's way more open. The problem is too many of you niggas are moving like you're in PR. This is not what criticism is. This is not RuPaul's best friend race or whatever the fuck y'all think it is. Where is the scholarship? Where is the care? Where is the knowledge? Where is the curiosity? I think that's really important. I don't think the prestige will be back in criticism maybe ever just because the way it is now is just very different. Yeah. You know, I think people are kind of little bitches about shit too, because nobody wants to call anybody out by name.
Yeah.
We just all like subtweet everybody and we move very weirdly. And I'm like, in the back days when like, you know, Pauline Kael and Andrew Saris disagree with each other, they called each other out by name in their respective publications.
They put it on wax. Absolutely.
They came for each other, you know, which is like my energy. That's what I like to do. And I think also one thing to keep in mind, if you're a critic, especially a black critic, do not think that your opinion is the first of its kind. I am reading this book called Returning the Gaze that's all about black criticism from the early 20th century into 1949.
Wow.
And so it's like, you wouldn't be thinking of black critics in the 20s, 30s, and 40s But they were writing for Black publications, and a lot of the things that we're talking about now, they were talking about then.
Yeah.
When my grandmother was a teenager. Like, a big problem with criticism today is, like, the lack of historical wherewithal of where you fit into things. Like, for me, you know, reading Returning the Gaze had me thinking about, oh, like, I align with a lot of Black critics from the 30s, for example, because they were straight up communists, Marxists. They were like not playing with Hollywood shit.
Also had good politics back then. It was nice.
Yeah. I was like, I mean, some of the way the ways people were talking about, say, like Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind, they were like, oh, we coming for these white people. Oh, yeah. Man, fuck this Hollywood shit. This is like, but then there was also Black critics who were like, fuck, I mean, what I find funny is like people describing the moment where they're like, finally, Hollywood cares about Black people. I'm like, do you realize how many niggas have said that for decades?
Yeah.
They said it in the 70s with Blaxploitation. They were like, Blaxploitation is the reason Hollywood was able to not fall into the ocean, basically, and fall apart because movies weren't doing well. Yeah. Blaxploitation was a way to, like, you know, cheaply made movies, making lots of money with an audience that hadn't...
reliable, yeah.
That was reliable and hadn't been, like, the focus for a second. And then look at how the 80s went. And then 90s. Yeah. And then, you know what I mean? So it's like, we've been here before, and I think that's really important to keep in mind, not just as a critic, but an audience member. Yeah. We have been here before in a lot of ways. The polish is a little different. Yes, there's way more Black people in front of and behind the camera right now in the halls of power of Hollywood. But I'm not sure that's actually a good thing, because I don't think Hollywood can be reformed. But that's my opinion. But I just want people to think a little deeper.
Well, I think this is part of the reason why I think projects like Maya Cade's The Black Film Archive are like so important. Because
oh, totally.
I think some of it comes from, and not to make excuses for folks, because it's a lot of just ignorant folks out there. But I do think a lot of that is access. Because if you know the films are there, you look for things about the films. And then, you know, maybe we can like stumble on a bit more of that. So for what it's worth, I want you to continue to fight that fight, because I more so I want to see it. I like that type of criticism. So I'm excited to see what else pops off in Wax. To close, though, I want to say, one, thank you. This has been so fun. There's actually a bunch of questions I didn't get a chance to ask. I think of critics, a good critic, as people who can see, like, what was there, why it was there, and maybe most crucially, like, what could have been, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious, like, for the what could have been, over the next few years, like thematically, what types of films are you hoping to see?
I just want to see cool shit with hot people. That's really it. I don't ask for much. I mean, for me, one thing that I've been sort of clocking and just tracking over the last few years, especially post-Obama era, post-Oscar so white, is how Black films treat the body. What are the embodied aspects of filmmaking? I think sometimes people think of watching a film as a purely intellectual exercise or an emotional one.
Yeah.
But one thing I really like to do as a critic is track my bodily reactions when watching a film and then like reverse engineer what in the filmmaking caused me to react this way, which is a lesson I learned watching Kathryn Bigelow's film Detroit from several years ago. Fuck that movie.
That was a divisive one.
Yeah, I had a near panic attack in that movie. I wanted to leave. I was physically ill watching that movie.
Yeah.
But it taught me an important lesson. And so I just want more embodied criticism. I'm wondering, though, if I can read a quote from something, if I can find it. No.
Please.
So right now I'm reading Michael Boyce Gillespie, who is an amazing film scholar. He wrote a book called Film Blackness, American Cinema, and the Idea of Black Film. And it completely challenged my ideas of how I think about Black film. And I'm just going to read a few questions he poses at the very end of the book. And this is a quote. What if Black film could be something other than embodied? What if Black film was immaterial and bodiless? What if Black film could be speculative or just ambivalent? What if film is ultimately the worst window imaginable and an even poorer mirror? What if Black film is art and not the visual transcription of the Black life world? That question, the last one in particular, has been very important to me. Like, why do I expect or even want a medium such as film to directly reflect the entirety of my life? And is that even possible? I think it's more fun to experiment, to be weird, to take these aspects of Black identity and Black living, which varies greatly throughout the diaspora, and like let it bloom into something weird and wonderful and imaginative that doesn't have to save people. I think a big reason why people turn to film so much for representation is because our political and material lives day to day are fucking terrible. Mm. And so you're hoping for progress, at least in this one small way. And I would ask people, one, please get just more politically involved and don't expect Hollywood to save you, because it's not going to. Representation will not save us.
It will not.
No amount of times a white person sees the quote unquote humanity of a Black character on screen, that's not going to save them from being racist. I'm sorry. We need to move on and expect different things from Black film and challenge ourselves as viewers, as critics, and the filmmakers themselves to have more fun, be more experimental, do the weird shit, take big swings while still having care towards your Black audience.
Angelica J. Bassian, thank you so much. For what it's worth, I wanna see all those too.
Yeah.
I wanna see all that too.
We'll see. I don't know, but we'll see.
What is that, with the way niggas be?
These niggas out here, I don't know, honey, but I will hope.
Yes. Well, thank you again so much. Seriously, I wish we had more time. This has been an awesome conversation. Tell folks where they can find you and your work.
So you can just find me on Vulture. I'm exclusively a writer for New York Magazine. So yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Angelica Bastian. And yeah, just find me at Vulture and in the pages of New York Magazine, you know, telling these hoes what they should be doing and what they ain't.
Yes, I click that link every time. For Colored Nerds was created by me, Eric Eddings, and Brittany Luce. It's supported by a production team at Stitcher, including producer Alexis Williams, story editor Gianna Palmer, social producer Elise Ellis, and engineer Marcus Hamm. Our theme music is by Willie Green. And look, y'all, we love hearing from you so, so much. So please shout us out on Instagram, at For Colored Nerds, on Twitter, at For Colored Nerds. You can find us everywhere, at For Colored Nerds. And tell your friends, too. We love it also when we're like, yo, my homie, cousin, best friend told me to listen to this episode and it was bomb. And then I subscribed. That's like my favorite song. So please do your friend, do your community a favor and share an episode and tell us which one it was.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.